Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Medieval History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Evan Zarkadas, your host, and in today's episode, I'm very excited to be talking with Dr. Anthony Kaldelis, professor of classics at the University of Chicago, to talk about his new book, The New Roman Empire, A History of Byzantium, published in 2024 by Oxford University Press. Hello, Anthony, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Evan. Thank you for having me on, and hello to everyone in the audience.
Yes, it is such a pleasure to have you. I know you've been with us, I think it was a few years ago with your previous book, Roman Land. Yes. So it's very excited to have you back for this new publication of yours, which I can't hide. I'm very excited about. So to start a little bit, we'd like to start with a little bit of a book summary in the beginning. So if you can... tell us a little bit about what the book is about, and how did you get the idea to write such a volume?
Okay, so I'm not going to summarize the contents of the book because that would sort of be insane.
Indeed.
The book is a new big history of what most people know as the Byzantine Empire from beginning to end. So from the foundation of Constantinople in the early 4th century to its fall to the Ottoman Turks in the middle of the 15th. So it covers almost 1,200 years. And it is primarily a narrative history, but it is leavened by a great deal of analysis of political, economic, social, religious history, so that the events that one encounters in the narrative make sense against the background of those sort of social categories of social existence. And it is not a textbook, so it's not written in a kind of dry, impersonal style. It is a what I call a history. It is a single author history where I synthesize sources and modern scholarship in order to produce a sort of coherent, integrated picture of the trajectory of this civilization from beginning to end, its high points and its low points, how it served the people who lived in it and how not. And to do so with a certain amount of engaging style and even, you know, occasional dry humor. So that's what the book is. It is meant to be a history. Whether it attains the status of a standard history or not remains to be seen.
Right, right. And what were the origins of this project for you personally?
Well, like the proximate origin was an editor of a journal who asked me to do it. I said no, because it's not a easy thing to do. And it's not something that is part of the sort of MO of my profession. In other words, historians these days, scholars at research universities, do not aim to be writing general histories, narrative histories, syntheses of material for the general public or even for the field. And my book tries to do both. Instead, we are mostly focused on specialized research with original arguments about this aspect or that aspect, or very, very granular studies of, you know, that result in articles on this manuscript and that event or whatever. So it's really just not part of our career objectives to do something like this, which is why there are really only two or three people before me in my field who have done it. The books of this kind that attained, you know, some sort of lasting presence or were in print for a while or still are, were Ostrogorsky, the book written in the 30s, in fact, though the version that most people will know was a revised one from the 50s. And Warren Treadgold, which is like 97 or something, and so I'm the next. So it's less frequent than once per generation, to be sure. So, you know, once my editor pitched it to me and I said no, but it you know, the idea kind of took hold, and it took me a few years to come around to it. But everybody understands that there's a need for a new synthesis every once in a while, because all of that specialized research that I told you about does have concrete results in changing our understanding of many, many things, improving our knowledge, giving us new models for interpretation. And it is good every once in a while to synthesize those into a picture and to see what it looks like. Obviously, any synthesis will have problems, and you know, this book will now just be a target for everyone who wants to say, oh, but actually, or but no, he's wrong about. Okay, but of course, that's part of the function of a book like this. It's like, well, here we seem to be here, right? So the way forward is either building on this or critiquing it. And that's kind of the function that it serves, in addition to making a narrative available to anyone who's not an expert, who wants to know what we're thinking inside the guild. Yeah.
Yeah. And would you say that it's more targeted towards a general audience, or is it both for researchers, also for a general audience that's not very well known, that doesn't very well know the history of Byzantium in general?
No, it has to be both. I certainly wrote it for the average intelligent reader, you know, who knows something about world history or antiquity or the Roman Empire generally or something like that. You don't need much more than that. I explain most of those things. So a general audience can definitely read the book. But see, that specialization in research that I mentioned earlier, that has resulted in a very fragmented field where, you know, someone working on the 5th century can often know very little, if anything, about the 12th or the 13th. And someone working on art history might just not know much or anything about the economy and so forth. So there are top level experts in every one of these subfields and subdisciplines, or whatever. I don't mean to demean anyone's field by calling it that, but I just mean that they're focusing on just a part of the whole picture of the society, might not know what's going on in scholarship on other parts. And so this is a good way for them to become acquainted with that. It could explain how the economy works, for example, is a very esoteric field that, you know, there are few experts in. And so in that sense, a book like this will serve a great many experts as well.
Yeah. And reading, again, I haven't finished the whole book, as you can imagine, but reading some aspects of it that I was very interested on, especially in the later empire, I definitely saw the language being again, very, very friendly to a generalized audience. And my question now is, how long did it took to combine all of these research? Because you did primary and also secondary research, combined that all together. And again, we're talking about this 1,000+ year history. So I kind of want to know a little bit, how was the whole process putting this together?
So the writing of it took me about 6 years, and it was very intense. Now, I should say that the research for the book is something that it turns out I have been doing for decades. So I was building on existing my existing knowledge of all periods. I'm one of very few people who work on the entire span. I've published in early, I've published in later, I've published in middle period texts and events and so forth. And so I am comfortable and familiar with most periods, and I have been reading the primary sources for decades, so it's not as if I was starting from scratch, right? However, I should qualify that 6 years by saying that I'm capable of very intense bouts of work, right? So something between 12 and 16 hours a day, pretty much nonstop, which I can keep up for months before I have to take a break. Anyway, there's that. Also, for most of that time, I was chair of a department, which was being subjected to intense austerity measures by its university for no good reason. But what that meant was, is that my job as chair, apart from just keeping things running on a sort of basic operational level, was preserving our basic programs, and there wasn't like much opportunity for offering new programs, expanding in some ways, making new hires, creating new whatever. And so paradoxically, I didn't have that much to do as chair. The kinds of things that one might want to do in order to improve, you know, like do new things in a department. And also part of it was COVID. When, you know, we were sent home, and I work from home, And so paradoxically, that sort of also increased my productivity during that period. I was just able to sort of concentrate in a more, even more intense way. So those, that's how those 6 years turn into a book of this size and complexity.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I can imagine. And yeah, okay. So that kind of got me into thinking a little bit, but I'll bring that question back again.
Okay, thoughts are welcome, but okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking how do we approach explaining a little bit about the book, but again, it's such intense. It's so much the content of it for this format of podcast. I guess what I can tailor to following that a little bit about the content of the book. What was one of your favorite chapters to write?
Favorite chapters to write. That's interesting. So some were a interesting challenge because I already knew the period it had worked on it before, let's say the Age of Justinian. And writing a chapter on the Age of Justinian, a few chapters, forced me to take a stand on some of the main interpretive problems of the period, and to try to sort out some problems that had sort of always been nagging me in the back of my mind, like, well, was it this way or was it that way? You know, there's scholars on both sides, and how am I ever going to figure this out? So that was an interesting challenge in areas that I was already very familiar with. I would say that the most surprising chapter, that is, that when I actually got around to doing the research for it and trying to sort, you know, figure out what was going on and have a position on what was going on, was probably the one in the 12th century in the Komneni. I was quite struck by the ambition of the foreign policy, especially of Manuel Komnenos, and his ability to, well, the ability of his economy to generate cash, and the different ways in which he tried to symbolically express his sort of, you know, prestige and prominence as a you know, world leader. And the ambition of his designs was really, really impressive, even though I think that in the end they sort of failed. But I came away with a very impressed by what he had tried to do, even though it didn't quite work out. So that was a bit of a surprise for me. I thought I would be more cynical about it and kind of more down on him, but it turned, he won me over. So I'll say that.
That's good. And so again, with my challenge, I'm trying to come up with questions for this interview of ours. I was trying to find something that most people that have a basic level of understanding of the history of Byzantium will understand. And the question that I always get as a student of Byzantine history is that of its name. And I guess I'll move there, our conversation, into you mentioned in the book that in no other field of research is the identity of the people being studied denied so strenuously as in the Byzantine studies. Can you expand a little bit on that? Because I know that from your previous research and work, there has been this debate of, is it Byzantium? Do we keep the name? And in your book, in your cover, I mean, I kind of saw the duality there, the new Roman Empire, and then in the bottom, a history of Byzantium. So you kind of combine those two very well, even in the title when you first pick the book. But can you expand a little bit from your knowledge and experience on this issue, I guess, of the name?
Sure. Though the name itself is not like a primary force in, you know, the sort of interpretation of history, especially when we're talking about, like, you know, socioeconomic structures and foreign policies and religious issues and so forth. It's not something that comes up in the book a lot.
Right.
In particular, since I don't use the terms Byzantium and the Byzantines in the book, only when I'm referring to something like Byzantine studies, which is a modern thing, not a medieval thing. However, the terms Byzantine and Byzantium are useful for identifying the field from a distance, and this is why I use it in the subtitle, so that people who perhaps are not familiar with this debate because the terminology hasn't yet, been sort of officially changed. The field doesn't have a consensus on this issue right now. So I think it's perfectly fine to continue to use those terms to point to the area of research that the book represents, right?
Mm-hmm.
But never to use those terms as substantives inside the book as if they were real things, because they are not, right? So to make a long story short, the civilization that we're talking about is the Roman state. You can call it the Roman Empire. I think in many periods of its history, that's a very misleading term. Empire means something in the modern languages, including English, that there's no equivalent for in the thought world of that time necessarily. There might be, there might not be. There's a question about whether it is an empire, be that as it may. It certainly wasn't Byzantine Empire. It was the Roman polity, the Roman monarchy, the Roman kingship or whatever. And it had a proper name, Romania, which they used in a vernacular sense, or very common. That was the common name for the society and state that they lived in, Romania, which translates to something like Roman land.
Mm-hmm.
And they themselves, the majority of the population, were Romans. They didn't just call themselves Romans, which is the typical evasion that 20th century scholarship used. They were Romans. So basically anyone who was a Greek-speaking Orthodox, or Chalcedonian Orthodox after the 7th century, or whatever. And I use those terms. Those are the terms used in the sources, and those are the terms that I use, and they're never creates a problem. I never needed to use any other term, except possibly in the context of Southern Italy, in let's say the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries, when I'm writing from the standpoint of someone in Italy or a Western power who are seeing, let's say the representatives of the armies of Constantinople in Southern Italy, calling them Romans is confusing because there's another set of Romans in Italy, which is the people of the city of Rome. And so in Italy, the term is a little bit confusing. And so there you have to be careful so as not to be confusing. So that's the only context, and it's a very marginal one. The terms Byzantine and Byzantium became field terms, like the way in which most of your audience understands. Oh, Byzantium, it was the empire of Byzantium where the Byzantines lived. Okay, both terms in that sentence refer to non-existent things. These are terms that acquired this meaning in the late 19th century. They're not that old. They're part of the process of creating an academic discipline, which we call Byzantine studies, in the late 19th century. And they are an extension of a long history in the West of denying the actual identity of this state and its people on the assumption that Roman things belong to the West, right? Roman Empire and all of its prestige and all of its good things and all of its bad things, but they are part of the Western legacy, and that other people don't really have a claim to them. And this is a very, very, very long history in the West of denying this. And Byzantine studies is essentially an outgrowth of that history. So Byzantine studies as an academic field inherited this predisposition to look at these people historically and say, no, you are not who you thought you were. We know who you thought you were. You were something else, because you couldn't have been that thing that you thought you were. And it's a really weird position to take, I think. And theoretically and methodologically, an impossible one post-World War II. Nevertheless, it continued, and it continued well into the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
In part because it was also mixed with some very confused ideas about race, which persist into the 21st century. We still have Byzantinists in the 21st century talking about mixed and unmixed races, which is, it blows my mind that this can happen. And an aversion to discussing ethnicity, because once you start talking about ethnicity, you have to start talking about the Romanness of these people, and that was taboo. So The field of Byzantine studies has created a massive apparatus of confusion and denial, and it hides behind all of these, phrases and evasions and training. Part of the training is how to learn to live with this cognitive dissonance of your sources saying one thing and you looking at them and saying, no, no, you're wrong about who you are. It's so weird. Anyway, the field is now, as far as I can tell, very quickly moving away from that model. Once you point this out, it is so absurd that you cannot in good conscience continue to do it. Now, certain people who are like over 70 and sort of very set in their ways, they're like, oh, Byzantium, the Byzantines, fine, whatever. But at the conferences that I've been to in the past 2 or 3 years, nobody wants to use those terms in a non-ironic way. So the question is, what are we going to replace them with? And that's a whole other discussion. Actually, I've written a separate little book, a little pamphlet about that. But that's a different issue.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I know that's definitely the one thing that I've been getting a lot from other scholars that don't really know the history of Byzantium. So thank you for expanding on that, and for our audience that's maybe approaching Byzantium for the first time through your book. So on that, what do you hope somebody that reads this book, let's say if there was one or two things that you hope they get out of it, what will it be?
Well, it depends on what presuppositions they come in with, so possibly some prejudices too. I mean, they might think that this was a society defined top to bottom by orthodoxy and religion, mm-hmm. in which case they will learn that it was much, much more than that. That was a part of it, very important, a central part of the culture, of course, but not the only thing going on. And in many important respects, not that important, depending on what you're looking at. On the other hand, I saw some of the Amazon reviewers. Well, I mean, these might be teenagers. I don't know who these people are, but they will say things like, there's too much religion in this book and too much theology. And why are you reading a history of Byzantium if you don't want to read? Anyway, because there is a lot of church history in here, of course. So I don't know what people are coming in with, what assumptions they're coming in with. So, okay. What would I hope they take away from this? Well, it's precisely the themes that I highlight in the preface or introduction, I can't remember what it's called now, which is that probably the most important thing about this state and society, because it's both at the same time, is its longevity, resilience, and durability, right? That I know that in Western thought, it's been traditionally associated with decline and fall, but
yeah,
right? The idea that a civilization that lasts 1,100 years, and by the way, not just any 1,100 years, but the whole medieval period, which is one of the most dangerous and difficult periods that any society can go through, and moreover, is not located in places where like you find Portugal or Japan or United Kingdom or whatever, but at the very intersection of Europe and Asia, like one of the most difficult and dangerous places to be, right? That it managed to survive that with its identity intact, its language, its institutions, its sense of its history, right? It's not like some massive overhaul took place at any particular time. They knew exactly who they were. That is the opposite of decline and fall. That is probably the most stunning example in world history of a societal resilience and the ability not only to withstand shocks, but to recover from them. And this is a recurring pattern that I find in its history, that the shocks to it are largely administered from the outside and kind of out of the blue. Arab conquests, Seljuk conquests, Fourth Crusade, things like that, where it's sort of unreasonable to expect, the leadership to have anticipated or have really even been able to withstand them. What's interesting about it is that the sources of resilience and recovery, which happened always, after every shock, were internal. So after every one of these setbacks, there is a long period of gradual recovery, economic growth, even cultural revival. And I find that to be the most, its defining characteristic, if we're interested in its internal right attributes, rather than just what happened to happen to it because of some external, now volcano blowing up or plague showing up or whatever, which they couldn't possibly have controlled. So I think that's the, and part of that, so in a certain sense, that's a problem. Why did this happen? How did it happen, right? And part of the answer is, another takeaway that I hope that readers, come away with, which is that it actually had a very strong sense of identity of who they were in relation to all the people around them, what set them apart and made them different, which gave their society a certain amount of resilience. Now, the complementary factor that I identify is precisely the role of the state. And so here I would disagree with a number of my colleagues who believe that the state was simply an exploitative mechanism, a set of distant elites who have no real connection to the people in the provinces who are doing the productive economic work of agriculture or pastoralism or whatever, and are just kind of exploiting them cynically from a distance. And all of that, identity talk is just kind of their propaganda and ideology. And I fundamentally do not agree with that picture. I find that elites in Constantinople and provincials are tied together with very, very strong bonds and networks. They belong to the same world. They understood this. And fundamentally, for all of its abuses and corruption and inefficiencies, the East Roman state is the one that most closely adhered to, it actually did the things that it was telling its subjects that it wanted to do. Especially sort of protect them from outside attack, and then also to provide justice and, maintain the religious order and things like that. And I think that this is part of the reason why so many of its provincials stuck with it, even at times when they might have had the opportunity to break from it. So they're very, very few, almost none. I mean, depends on how you define them. Attempts at provincial separatism, agrarian revolts, right? Splinter states. So precisely all of the factors that brought down the Carolingian Empire, the Abbasid Caliphate, the Mongol Empire, like these things come and go within a century or two, at most two and a half. They don't last for 1,200 years.
Yeah, and that's what I think. That was the message that I really liked from this book, also of contrasting these things. Just again to show the very rich history of the Byzantine Empire. Yeah. Thank you so much. I'm wrapping up with my time here. Was there anything you wanted to add about the book before we go? Anything that I forgot?
Anything that I want to add about what in particular, or?
Yeah, anything that you think I should have asked that I haven't?
No, what I'd like to say about the book, or rather the process of writing it, is not something that you could have anticipated and therefore asked about. But for a year before I began to actually write it, that is, well, to use an old-fashioned expression, put pen to paper, though I don't think any paper was harmed in the making of this book, until it's printing. I spent about a year studying and researching different types of prose to find the right mode or style that I thought would be appropriate for something that addressed both experts and a general audience. And I had to become very self-conscious about certain traits of scholarly writing that we have all internalized in the way that we write articles and, monograph chapters and things like that, which are, I think, counterproductive for this kind of writing. So things like defensive writing, where you phrase everything in the expectation that it will be attacked by 20 other scholars. And so you have to hedge everything. So to narrow the point down to something as minuscule that can't be critiqued. A lot of scholarly writing does that to avoid sort of self-conscious writing, like second or where I'm reflecting on ourselves, like in order to understand this, we need to do, no, there's no we, there's no you, that I am creating a tableau, right? I'm presenting things so that you see them in a kind of classical French style. In fact, it was the classical French style of the 17th century that in a certain sense appealed to me in this way, where, obviously sometimes I become self-aware of like, there are different schools of interpretation there, you know, we occupy a certain subjectivity, we have to be careful about this. But for the most part, I'm just trying to present a picture and not inject myself into the writing, except sometimes to make wry observations.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that the readers appreciate this because I'm constantly looking backward and forward to see what's changed. And sometimes they're very poignant. It's kind of like very striking contrasts that emerge when you see how things get flipped on their head or turned inside out or the opposite of what it used to be. And so I like to find ways, often through very striking quotations, which are always short, to illustrate these kinds of changes. So the manner in which I wrote the book is something that I took some trouble over. It's not my, well, or anyone's usual scholarly prose. I hope I avoided most of the vices of scholarly prose, which are many.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I will personally add that for a reader that picks up this book, it will be one of the most approachable ways to study about
good.
Out there.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Thank you.
Perfect. Well, Anthony, that's all the time I have with you today. Thank you again very much for being with me, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you, Evan. It's great to be on, and I appreciate this opportunity. Take care.
Take care.